You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, as part of Wisconsin's ongoing budget discussions, a proposed rule would change the way quarries are regulated in the state. Last week, we learned that the Joint Finance Committee was reviving some provisions as part of the state transportation budget that would limit the authority of local governments when it comes to regulating quarry blasting. Former Governor Scott Walker vetoed similar provisions in 2017. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's been following this story. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, can you start by describing the kind of regulations we're talking about, local regulations, when it comes to quarries?
Sure. We're talking about blasting. We're talking about limits to hours of operation. We're talking about local governments wanting more control over air and water quality. And a lot of this has, it sounds similar to situations that local governments that we've seen with industrial sand mining or frack sand mining, but this is separate. This isn't about frack sand mining. Mm-hmm. This is about your quarries, and this is about sand pits used for transportation projects and infrastructure. So with regard to blasting, the state has limits on how near structures, you know, what kind of noise levels, vibration levels, that sort of thing. And but this legislation or this motion limited local ability at all to restrict blasting beyond what the state has in its statutes. Also blocks local governments from setting local air and water standards or issuing air and water permits from towns, you know, villages or counties.
What case is the committee and supporters of this change making for this this preemption?
Well, the Aggregate Producers of Wisconsin, it's the lobby group, basically, for the aggregate producers, the quarries, and the gravel pits. They say that these types of, this patchwork of local ordinances that go beyond what the state sets is increasing costs. And in some cases, they say the restrictions are so bad that they're having to ship materials from other counties or outside of towns, and that increases the costs on taxpayers who are paying for these road projects. And they say that the restrictions are so bad in some places that quarries can't even operate.
Can you talk about some of the communities that have added these restrictions on for quarries? What kind of things have they done?
Well, this all seems to have a lot. I mean, it's not only about this one town in Dane County, but this is the Deerfield keeps coming up in the different articles and the discussions that I've seen on this. Deerfield's situation is pretty unique. There's a 165-year-old historic church that's like right across the street from a quarry. And the quarry had been operating kind of sleepily for a while. Then years back, I think it was before, might have been 2013, 2014, a new owner purchased the property. And they increased the activity, so there was more blasting, there was more truck traffic, etc. And the town board members told me that they were worried that this blasting would damage the church. And they set restrictions that have been cited numerous times by the aggregate producers and others who have been seeking to kind of dial back those local controls.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter in Eau Claire, about a provision in the state budget that would limit local government's abilities to regulate quarries beyond existing regulations. And that's a key that a lot of supporters of this point to, Rich, that there are existing state and federal regulations. What kind of things do we know are in those?
Well, like I was talking about the blasting restrictions, I can't name off every one individually, but you know, these quarries and industrial sand mines, for that matter, they're regulated by the Mine Safety and Health Administration. They're regulated by the EPA. They're regulated by the DNR. You know, Department of Safety and Professional Services is the state outfit that regulates blasting. So there's all kinds of things on the books with regard to how these places operate. But the town board members in Deerfield said, while the state does regulate blasting, there are only two inspectors positions in the entire state to look into complaints that a quarry operator might have been exceeding its the standards set for vibrations and sound. And those vibrations really are what people are concerned about, because just covering industrial sand mining in Trempealeau County, I've heard stories about people's dishes flying out of their cupboards when a sand mine a quarter mile down the road sets off its explosives. So these companies are supposed, they have to notify people that a blast is coming, but it still takes people by surprise.
Why is this provision in the state budget in particular?
Well, I can't tell you why it's in the state budget, but things that are in the state budget, you know, the budget has to be approved. So a lot of times people will include things that might not be able to pass on their own into the state budget, into an omnibus type of bill. So we saw this, it was inserted in a different way in the last state budget, but there's this thing called the 999 motion, which is kind of a clearinghouse where policy items can get thrown in at the last minute by the Joint Finance Committee. So that's how it made it into the 2017-2019 budget. But as you mentioned in the lead up to our discussion, former Governor Scott Walker vetoed it, and he said that he vetoed it because he objected to inserting a major policy item into the budget without sufficient time to debate its merits. So it's in here again. We'll see what Governor Tony Evers has to say about it when he gets his veto pen out. But it's also been an interesting discussion from the groups that represent the local governments. I've heard that the League of Municipalities told me that they're not going to make a big fuss about it, even though they don't like the loss of local control. But they also pointed out that the same budget includes a big increase for local transportation funding, which they've been calling for a long time.
So even though they're not wild about the idea, that is not the hill they're going to fight on this time around, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I think what's really telling is that, you know, I spoke with one person from the League of Municipalities. This isn't really their fight. The League of Municipalities is about cities for the most part, and the Towns Association and the Counties Association, which might have the most skin in this game, they're not saying anything. They said they're still reviewing it last week, and I've tried to reach out to them since, but they haven't replied. So, you know, it's hard to say why they're not commenting on it, but it might be a controversial issue that they'd rather not discuss.
So as things stand, the Joint Finance Committee passed the budget with this in it. Is there any talk of taking it back out in the general legislature, or are there more high-profile items that's going to be on people's minds?
Well, this is one, even in the transportation budget that was ratified, I guess you could say, by the Joint Finance Commission. This is like the last little piece in like 80 pages of changes that the JFC included. So whether it even gets noticed will be a question. But I asked the aggregate producers, I said, well, this was vetoed in 2017. So what happens if it gets vetoed again? And they said that, you know, they'll just keep talking to lawmakers. And who knows, we might see standalone legislation or we might see it pop up in the next state budget.
We'll see how that turns out. Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. We talked to him about provisions in the proposed state transportation budget that would limit local government's ability to regulate quarry blasting. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new bipartisan bill being proposed in the state legislature would require cities and towns to pay for health insurance premiums for the families of police officers who were killed in the line of duty. If the bill passes, it will be in line with a law already on Wisconsin's books for the families of firefighters who die on duty. Our next guest is one of the bill's co-sponsors and a former police officer. Senator Van Wongert is a Republican who represents Wisconsin's 21st State Senate District that includes Racine. Senator Wongert, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you guys taking up the topic.
Well, sadly, this is a very timely topic. Two officers in southeastern Wisconsin dying in the line just over the last day or so. Your thoughts on the news from the two communities?
Well, this is really a bittersweet topic. John Hetland, who died taking action to intervene in an armed robbery in Racine, came on the department about 24 years ago, and I actually trained him as traffic training and other traffic related training as a training officer. And so I knew him personally, and it's really hard because he truly was the type of officer that had a service heart. He would definitely be somebody that would run towards the gunfire instead of away from it. And course, he was willing to intervene in this issue that went on. So it's pretty sad.
Well, my condolences to you and the departments in both Racine and Milwaukee. Both have lost officers in the last day. Well, that brings us to this legislation you're proposing. What would it do?
Well, you had it right in the lead. In 2009, they had legislation that brought this legislation forward for firefighters. I don't know why law enforcement wasn't considered at the same time. I think it was kind of the focus. I believe we had lost a couple of firefighters. This became an issue at that time. And so the firefighting lobby came forward to get that through for firefighters. And it was not thought of until all of a sudden we lost a law enforcement officer that this came up. So we started looking at some municipalities do already step in and do cover the health care for the spouse, or they have done that in the past. Racine is one of those that has done it in the past. But you may have a situation where you have a smaller department that has a half a dozen or even fewer than that. They lose an officer in the line of duty, and they're not able to be able to take that burden off of the officer's family. And so this, anytime we have an officer lost in the line of duty, it's not just a loss to that community. It's a loss to our entire state. It's a loss to us all because the rule of law is so important. And what do we have if we're not secure in our environment? So this is a way that we can make sure that those officers don't have to focus and worry about what may happen with their family while they are stepping in to make those split-second decisions to put their life on the line.
So on a practical level, what does this require of Wisconsin communities? What will local governments have to provide?
Well, what would happen is, with this, if this law passes, what would happen is if that department already offers that health care to the family, if an officer is killed in the line of duty, then the spouse and their dependent children would have that health care continued until either the spouse remarries or until the children are out of the household. So what it would mean is that those municipalities would continue to make that payment for whatever the department provides for health care, and then we would reimburse them through the funding that would come from the state.
Talk about the fiscal side of things. What kind of cost would this be for the local governments and or the state government?
Well, local government, they actually wouldn't have any cost because they would be reimbursed by the resources that would come into the state, on the state side of things. So if an officer lost their life in the line of duty, the municipality would underwrite the cost of that health care, would continue that spouse's health care, and then that cost would be passed on to the state, and they would be reimbursed. The funding for that we have identified would be through the police and fire fees that are collected off of each line, phone line, that is provided. Right now, if you look at your phone bill, you'll see a 75-cent fee that's supposed to go towards police and fire. Well, when it says police and fire fee, right now that's actually not directly going to police and fire. So we would be looking to make sure that some of those dollars go towards paying for this cost. The cost right now would be prospective, so once this passes, it would be going forward. We wouldn't be going back and looking at people that might qualify who have potentially died in the line of duty previous to passing this bill. So it would be as we go forward, we'd be looking at it. So right now, hopefully it wouldn't be a huge cost each year, but it sure is becoming more routine that we're losing officers. And in the line of duty, we've lost several in Milwaukee. In the last year, we've lost four officers in the line of duty. And although this officer last night in Milwaukee that was killed on their way home, I understand from their shift by a fourth offense drunk driver, that wouldn't count because they actually weren't involved in performing their duties either on or off duty. Because, you know, the police officer never really off duty. So if you're intervening in some illegal activity and you lose your life, they would be eligible for that to their family. If the individual's young enough and they don't have a wife and they don't have children, then there wouldn't be any commitment that would be necessary by the community or the state.
Have you and your fellow lawmakers looked to see what other states are doing?
There are several states that do this. I can't give you a number right offhand, but there are several other states that actually do this now.
And do you have a timeline on this bill?
Well, we'd like to get it up and get it on the floor. It's probably not going to happen until the fall. We've got great support in both houses. So we're looking at getting it through the process, be able to get it scheduled and get it on the floor, and most likely it'll be in the fall session.
And is this something you're seeing support from both parties on?
Oh, absolutely. We have support from both sides of the aisle. And I think everybody recognizes that, even more so now, since we have had several officers lost. I mean, it was more than 30 years that they lost an officer in Milwaukee, and we lost three, you know, in the line of duty. And, you know, the last time we lost an officer in Racine was in 1973. I'd been on the department about a year, and we lost Jim Fine, who was a detective. In the line of duty, he was shot responding to a domestic violence call. So we haven't had those losses in the line of duty, and now we've had one now. So let's hope this is the last we have for a long, long time to come.
Senator Wongard, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And I just hope that everybody keeps these officers in their prayers and their families.
Senator Van Wongard is a Republican who represents Wisconsin's 21st State Senate District, including Racine, talking about a bill he's co-sponsoring that would require local governments to cover health insurance for families of police officers killed in the line of duty. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Marijuana possession and use is still illegal at the federal level and at the state level here in Wisconsin. But several states, including our neighbors in Michigan, have passed laws at the state level to allow for the consumption and possession of cannabis in some capacity. In Michigan's case, it's been legal for residents at least 21 years old to use medical marijuana since 2008. And just this past year, the state passed a proposal that would make recreational marijuana legal. But Michigan's had a tough time regulating the drug, and these regulatory issues were the focus of a recent piece from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee Hall is the managing editor at WCIJ. Dee, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, this piece written by journalism student Rochelle Wilson. Why did WCIJ want to take a look at our neighbors' marijuana laws in Michigan in particular?
Well, one of the things is that Michigan is one of the first in the upper Midwest, if not the first in the upper Midwest, to legalize recreational marijuana. Medical marijuana is already legal in places like Minnesota and Illinois. But this was the first one of our neighbors that was actually going the route of legalizing recreational.
And easier said than done, I think, is a part of the conclusion of this piece. What kind of wrinkles is Michigan contending with now?
Well, we talked to a top policy expert in Michigan, and he told Rochelle that essentially, even though they had had medical marijuana legalization for about a decade, they still had never quite figured out how to regulate it in a very smooth way. He described it as a complicated system that no one could figure out. So a new governor came in, and she basically scrapped the old system and is combining the recreational marijuana legalization regulations along with the medical marijuana to make it what's supposed to be a smoother system that makes a lot more sense.
One question is, who can sell marijuana now that it's recreationally legal? Who, where, and why? What kind of objections are you seeing from local governments there?
So right now it's in a weird little limbo situation, because although you can consume marijuana, you cannot sell it to anybody. So where these people are getting their marijuana to consume it recreationally is an open question. But you can gift it. So some entrepreneurs have figured out a way to gift marijuana, to sell you an item, and then with that comes with a free side gift of marijuana.
So buy two surprisingly expensive used books was one example.
For example.
And get marijuana alongside.
And get some edibles for free. So that's the way they're handling it right now in Michigan. So, but later on, you can also grow your own. So you can have up to 12 plants and you can possess up to 2.5 ounces. So they're in a limbo right now. They have not allowed sales yet. And then sales will be decided by local jurisdictions, by municipalities. And that's what we focused on a lot was the sort of opt-in option that they have in their regulations.
What are you seeing when it comes to a local community opting in or out of marijuana sales?
So 56% of voters overall approve this, and Michigan is a state that has initiatives. We don't here in Wisconsin. So the citizens, the voters can force the government to do something they want them to do. So 56% of people said yes. Many of those communities that said yes, however, when it comes down to the city council level to either approve or to block recreational marijuana sales, a lot of them are blocking them because they just don't know how it's going to play out. They're concerned about the difference in jurisdiction between the federal law, which prohibits it, and the state law, which allows it. And so what they're finding is not many communities have decided, yeah, we're not going to allow sales here.
At least one community you looked at this as a potential economic opportunity, in part maybe to revive blighted areas.
Yes, that was Madison Heights. Rochelle talked to the mayor there, who is hoping that this new legalization effort will really lead to a revitalization for his community. He was mentioning a bunch of derelict industrial sites in the town. It's mostly a blue-collar town, retired and current auto workers, factory workers. And so he is hoping that this push will reinvigorate these sites, and also that many of the people in the community are already medical marijuana users, and he feels like bringing the medicine closer to the patients is going to be good for everybody.
A lot of the communities in Michigan, it sounds like, are taking a wait-and-see approach to see what other places go through when they do this. And some states, maybe like Wisconsin, are taking a wait-and-see approach. What kind of questions are raised in Michigan that might be a factor in lawmakers' thinking here in Wisconsin?
Well, I know that Representative Melissa Sargent has a broad legalization bill that she's introduced. It's only got Democratic co-sponsors, as far as I know, as of 2 weeks ago. That bill would have an opt-in, opt-out provision. And precisely because of the concern about whether local communities really are going to warm up to the idea of sales, whether perhaps they like the idea, the general idea of people having the freedom to use marijuana, but they don't like the specifics of having a marijuana dispensary in their neighborhood or on the corner or in their downtown. So there, I think that bill sort of anticipates that potential conflict.
Dee, thanks a lot for sharing this reporting with us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She joins us today to talk about a recent piece from WCIJ that takes a look at Michigan's marijuana laws and why it's been difficult for the state to figure out exactly how to regulate the drug. Now we take a broader look at marijuana laws across the country. There are currently 33 states that allow medical marijuana, 11 recreational. There's a patchwork of laws from state to state, and as we just heard, some difficult issues to sort out within states as well. Robert Mikos is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University and an expert in marijuana laws. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we just heard there, Robert, the work just begins once legalization is passed in some ways. What are some of the big issues that states have to sort out when they decide to legalize marijuana?
Yeah, it's a lot more complicated than simply legalizing the drug. In a sense, states have to figure out what to replace prohibition with. And to do that, they have to answer a lot of questions, like will they allow users to grow their own? How much will they allow users to possess? Who are they going to allow to use the drug? Just medical users? And then for what sort of medical conditions, or all adults. There's also a lot of questions that surround the supply of the drug. Who will states allow to grow and sell the drug commercially? What sort of regulations are they going to impose on them? Will they limit the potency of the drug? Will they restrict its advertising? Will they let local communities opt out of this whole system? So there's a whole slew of questions that goes along with moving from prohibition to a more civil regulatory framework.
Underlying all of this, too, is the fact that whatever a state says, pot, marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, right?
Yeah, that certainly makes everything more complicated. The states can actually get away with quite a bit in this domain, but having the federal government kind of looming over them with a very strict prohibition, at least a strict prohibition on the books, makes it a lot trickier. For example, just to give one example on the medical marijuana side, to get around the federal prohibition, the states have tried to involve physicians, but physicians, of course, are going to be worried about losing some of their privileges and licenses with the federal government if they go ahead and, say, prescribe this forbidden drug to a patient. So the states have had to be clever in writing their regulations in a way that doesn't expose these important parties like physicians to federal liability. So that's why in all of those medical marijuana states right now, they don't ask physicians to write a prescription for marijuana, because if you do that, you'll get in trouble with the federal government. Instead, they ask physicians to issue what's called a recommendation for marijuana. So states have, in writing their laws, they just had to be aware of all the obstacles that are posed by the federal government and do what they can to get around some of those obstacles.
There was concern about a back and forth. The Obama administration had an advisory saying, okay, let's not prioritize marijuana enforcement in states that have legalized. We had President Trump's first Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who sure looked like he might go the other way on that. That never seemed to happen. What is the current state of affairs when it comes to federal enforcement of marijuana laws in states that have legalized?
It really hasn't changed much from the Obama administration, notwithstanding former Attorney General Sessions' much dimmer view of marijuana and marijuana legalization. Right now, the federal government and federal prosecutors still aren't prosecuting people who are growing and selling marijuana in compliance with state law. They're just not an enforcement priority. In part, that's because Congress has gotten in on the act, and Congress for the last few years in the DOJ's budget has actually barred the DOJ, the Department of Justice, from using any of its money, any of its budgeted funds to prosecute people who act in compliance with state medical marijuana laws. So in a sense, the Trump administration's hands are tied when it comes to marijuana. But I think that recreational marijuana laws as well have just become so popular and have reached into so many different states that right now the Department of Justice just doesn't have the resources or the will to try to engage in a crackdown. So the rhetoric may be a little bit different from the Obama administration, but the practice on the ground really hasn't been all that different.
Robert Mikos is with us. He's a professor of law at Vanderbilt University, an expert in marijuana laws. He's with us to talk about the state-by-state implementation of laws regulating cannabis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a change in marijuana laws at the federal level, at the Wisconsin level? If it were legalized, how would you like to see that put into practice? We'll go to your calls now. Jacob starts us off in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hey, Rob and Robert, thanks for taking my call. It's happy to be with you.
What'd you want to bring up, Jacob?
Well, you know, in my opinion, I think that the prohibition on marijuana has been a colossal failure, and I think to continue to keep it prohibited is unsafe, and I'm speaking from experience because, Rob, I was in high school less than 15 years ago. I'm a young adult, and I can say from experience that it was 100 times more easy, or easier, if I wished, to get my hands on cannabis than it was alcohol. And I don't think that that's the way it should be. I don't think that a 16, 15-year-old should be able to have access to mind-altering drugs like that. And that's the way it is currently, and so that's what I think needs to change. And I think that prohibition is long overdue. It needs to happen at a national, state level, and there needs to be an overhaul.
Jacob,
thank you.
Thanks for the call. Robert, that brings us to the idea of, okay, how is pot regulated? How, as Jacob says, do we try to keep it out of the hands of minors who are better off without it?
Yeah, so what states have done so far, especially those states that have legalized this for non-medical purposes, All of them have set an age limit that is identical to the one for alcohol. So you have to be at least 21 years old to buy the drug. And typically they will regulate licensees the same way that they regulate alcohol licensees. So they'll say that you can lose your license to grow and sell marijuana if you knowingly sell to a minor. And they typically require them to card customers at the door, so they won't even allow a minor into a particular store. Now, that doesn't mean that people can't resell the drug. You know, someone who's 21 can go in and buy some amount of marijuana, walk out with it, and sell it to resell it to minors. But states do try to regulate the access of minors to this drug. They also tend to restrict advertising the drug in outlets where it might be seen by minors, TV shows, things like that. You're not allowed to advertise there if a certain portion of the audience is going to be underage.
And how about product safety, potency, purity, things like that? Do we see in states marijuana inspectors who make sure it's what it says on the tin?
States are certainly trying to do that. Every state that has legalized or the commercial supply of the drug requires licensed vendors to test their products for a variety of reasons. They want those vendors to test them to see if there's any harmful chemicals in there, like pesticides. But they also want them to test their products to make sure that they, you know, consumers know what's in there, how much of the active ingredient in marijuana, the THC, is actually going to be in there. And then you have to report those results typically on the label for the product. So consumers should have a lot more information about what they're putting into their body from these licensed stores than they have now buying from a street-level dealer.
Talking about marijuana legalization and what happens after legalizations, how states put rules and laws into place, the issues they have to contend with. Robert Mikos is with us from Vanderbilt University. Back to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Crandon. Kevin, hi.
Hello, yeah. Taking off Schedule 1 for the federal part of it, yes, should be legal in Wisconsin medically and recreationally, just as it is in Michigan. I'm up here in the northern part of the state, and we're relatively close to a dispensary on the other side of the line, and they're going gangbusters. They're making plans on building two or three buildings for growing. Their store is in an area where there's no one else around, no houses, no other businesses or anything. And, Americans need to get over it and get over themselves and just let the weed be free.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call. Now, Kevin, near the border there, as he mentioned, Robert, we have states where it's legal, states where it's illegal. Do we know if we have a lot of cross-border traffic?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things about marijuana, you know, this has been driven by the states, and many states have said, you know, we should have the ability to legalize this drug if we want, but that can impact neighboring states. You know, certainly when commercial sales get up and running in Michigan, that's going to make the drug more available in Wisconsin as well. People can just jump across the state line to buy it. We've already seen that in Colorado. There have been estimates even from state agencies there that a fairly sizable portion of the sales that take place in Colorado are actually destined for people in other states. People will go in, buy the drug at multiple stores, and then take it with them back home or maybe take it back to another state and resell it there. So what's happening elsewhere certainly can have impacts well beyond that local jurisdiction. And that's a big sticking point with marijuana regulation, is just when you allow the states to kind of craft their own policies, that's going to have impacts on other states, not just with prohibition states, but legalization states as well. There's been a concern among legalization states. One of the big rationales for legalizing this drug is the promise that it will generate a lot of new tax revenues. And that may be true in the short term, but if another state next door legalizes the drug and charges a lower tax on the drug, your home state's tax revenues are probably going to go down as well. So these cross-border shipments of the drug are a concern for both prohibition states as well as legalization states.
Let's bring on one more caller. Renee is with us in Manitowish Waters. Renee, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Renee?
Yes. My son was killed by a person that was had been smoking marijuana for the full day. The total reason for the accident was because he was very high. People that say that you know, it makes no effects and we just have at it have had nothing bad happen to you because of marijuana. His wife, his son, and everybody involved with my son changed their life drastically because of marijuana.
Renee, I'm very sorry for your loss. Thank you, though, for sharing that story. Robert, this is another issue, drinking while under the influence of marijuana. How have states tackled that?
It's tough. That's certainly a tragic case. I think the legalization states have said, they see the danger involved with marijuana legalization and driving under the influence of the drug. But to them, the proper response isn't banning the drug outright, but instead it's trying to tackle that particular problem. And they've approached it in a few different ways. Unfortunately, no one has the silver bullet. No one has the breathalyzer that we now have for alcohol that can test reliably for the presence of marijuana in someone who's driving. So instead, states have to prove impairment some other way, and that can be a little bit challenging. But the states have also taken a second, harder stance on driving under the influence. Some states have created these, they're called per se DUI laws. And these laws make you liable, make you criminally liable if you drive with the presence of any amount of an illicit substance in your blood, including marijuana. So some states, until they figure out what it means to be impaired by marijuana, until they figure out a way for police to reliably test it, are taking a very strict approach towards DUI because of these concerns over how it can impair drivers.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Mikos is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University. He joined us for a look at cannabis laws state by state. You can read Rochelle Wilson's piece on Michigan's marijuana laws, by the way, over at wisconsinwatch.org.